and start with Representative Albright's bill. So you can start your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The bill before us that is for information purposes only is a bonding request. House File 517 for the Hennepin County Medical Examiner's Facility Bonding. Just as a reminder, members, last year in the bonding bill, it was provided with $2.68 million. As part of that bonding bill, which afforded them the opportunity for pre-design and engineering site development. We are back now for the full measure of the request, which is $25.932 million. I do have a couple of testifiers today, one from my hometown, as well as the Department Administrator for the Hennepin County Medical Examiner's Office, Melissa Lalek, if she's here. And so I'm just going to give you a brief overview to the bill itself while she makes her way towards the testifier's table. The new facility will provide forensic death investigation and autopsy services for Dakota, Hennepin, and Scott counties.
I think the sheriff has arrived.
What did he do?
He did great.
Please continue, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to see you again. Hennepin County foresees this new facility as a space where they could assist these other counties beyond the three named to assist with forensic investigations. There are a whole host of reasons why this project is not only very, very important but vital to the counties that use it, but to the state in the larger measure. With that, I'm going to turn over testimony to the individual sitting to my right, your left, who can share with you some of the broader implications for why this bonding project must be appropriated in the bonding bill this year. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
So, good afternoon. My name is Melissa Lalek, and I'm the Department Administrator for the Medical Examiner's Office serving Hennepin, Dakota, and Scott counties. I work directly with Dr. Andrew Baker, the Chief Medical Examiner. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. We've had the privilege to speak with a number of senators and representatives recently about our new regional medical examiner facility bonding request and share some of the details of our mission and our project. What I would like to show you is a video that's a virtual walkthrough of our office, which will truly show why we are in need of a new regional medical examiner's facility.
Examiner for Hennepin, Dakota, and Scott counties. Our office, currently located in downtown Minneapolis, serves approximately 1.7 million Minnesotans, or roughly one-third of the population of the state of Minnesota. I'm going to give you a tour of some of the key points of our current facility in downtown Minneapolis that illustrate the need for a 21st century, state-of-the-art, new regional medical examiner's facility serving our part of the state. This is the body cooler where the remains of all of our decedents are stored. Our body cooler is designed to hold approximately 36 decedents. Because of the growth of our operation and our regional service model, on most days we are actually at or over capacity in terms of body storage. Ideally, in our new medical examiner's facility, on day one we will have a cooler that will be able to store in excess of 100 sets of human remains. It will also provide us the surge capacity we need should we ever have to handle a mass fatality incident. This is the autopsy suite where all of the postmortem examinations take place. We only have four autopsy stations in this room, which is fewer than half the number that an organization the size of ours needs. One of the concerns we have about a room such as this is because we are using a retrofitted ventilation system, we often have odors and possibly even biological or infectious agents leaving the room and permeating parts of the building they have no business being in. In addition to limiting our ability to adequately ventilate the room, The low ceilings in the current autopsy suite also ensure optimal autopsy photography. This room is one of several areas in the current facility where we store evidence. As you can see from the size of this room, it is far too small for us to comfortably accomplish our mission. Here you can see dozens of boxes of various medications that have been brought in from death scenes. This part of the building is the investigator's office. This is the part of the building that is staffed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, because we never close. This room is far too small. We don't have enough space for each of our investigators to even have his or her own workstation. They have virtually no natural light or other creature comforts to improve the morale of the workspace. The hallway we're in right now is typical of the majority of the lower level of the medical examiner's facility. As you can see, the hallways are narrow, the ceilings are low, there are numerous random rooms that come off on either side of the hallway. This building has served us reasonably well for 20 years, but it's time to move from a space like this into a 21st century medical examiner's facility that will serve the region until at least 2050. The current regional medical examiner's facility serving Hennepin, Dakota, and Scott counties is undersized, it's outdated, it's in a location that's detrimental to customer service, and it provides none of the features required to recruit and retain the kind of talent needed to staff a 21st century medical examiner's office.
So in summary, in addition to the video, our work informs law enforcement, the courts, the media, and every facet of public safety and public health. Support for a new regional medical examiner facility will ensure that we can continue to provide world-class death investigation services to all that we serve. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, parliamentary inquiry.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if an oral amendment would be appropriate to the amendment, to the bill.
I think the way to do that would just be to just communicate directly with the chair of the Capital Investment Committee. We're not acting.
Correct.
The bills are moving.
I just wanted to verify for sake of convenience if it were more applicable to do it here before we got to Capital Investment, or just do it directly when we get to Capital Investment.
Yeah, I think that's probably...
You. We stand prepared to answer any questions the members or the chair might have.
Thank you, Representative Albright. One of the questions that I had taken a tour through that facility, and I don't know if other members have, but if you do have an opportunity, I think it doesn't take you very long to figure out that they need a new building and the pressures that the facility is under and the people who work there. They need a new building. One of the things that we heard about was just the broader reach of the facility beyond the three counties that are served, but actually kind of goes out a little bit more and has other services beyond that. And I think that's important from a capital investment standpoint, that it's not a Hennepin County deal. But in fact, has a little bit of a broader reach. Maybe if you want to just touch on that.
Yeah, I sure can. A couple of things regarding that, why we have to have a new facility. One is we have an education mission. So unlike any other accredited medical examiner's office in Minnesota, we have a formal teaching mission that includes medical students, pathology residents, and a forensic fellowship program in forensic pathology. So we train future medical examiners. All pathology residents from the University of Minnesota spend at least 1 month with us, and we operate one of only 35 accredited fellowship programs in the nation, and we've done so for over 30 years. So the chief of Anoka, of Ramsey, and then also Hennepin and previous chiefs who have all been alumni of our program.
And do you, if there's an area around the state that isn't served, do you get the work that they're supposed to do sent to you, or?
We do have a model where we accept referral cases at this point, which means if we're a medical examiner coroner state. So if there is a coroner county and they want us to do their autopsies, we accept them. The agreement with Dakota and Scott counties is called a joint powers agreement. So if somebody wants to join us as a joint powers, they can also do that. So that's our two financial models. And we help out any way we can. We have employees and members of our staff serving on committees in for emergency management, for professionalism all across the United States.
And forgive me if you covered this before I got here, but is there a site for the building yet, or has that not been determined?
There is a site. We have plans, and we're moving forward. We just finished schematic design. Our site is out in Minnetonka, and it is part of the land where the Hennepin County Homeschool is located. So it is slightly west of 494 on 62.
All right. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll just briefly echo what you said. If I have toured it, and it is absolutely difficult, kind of queasy-inducing work that some of these people are doing. But more importantly, they're doing it in a shoebox with bodies just shoved into storage spaces because they just don't have the room to deal with the volume of work that's coming in. And I understand that there's a nationwide shortage of people stepping up to this work. And as a training facility, the whole state is dependent upon them helping us create the future workforce for this. So thank you.
Thank you. And, yeah, it is a little bit I had to sit down a little bit. I just pretended to be reading something, but I wasn't actually reading. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was kind of giggling a little bit because Representative Zerwas was eating something during that presentation.
He doesn't have any problem with that.
I guess not. No, he could eat during anything, I know. So, but the question I just had, and forgive me too if you already said something about this, is like, where are these, there are other facilities obviously located around the state, and could you just kind of review for us where those are? And, you know, it's a little mysterious to me, kind of who covers what.
Oh, absolutely. There's four primary medical examiner offices in the state of Minnesota, and one is in Anoka. And Quinn Strobel is the chief medical examiner there, also run the NIAVA program. And they serve primarily the northern part of the state and some other counties in the area through a basis where they provide those services. Ramsey County, Ramsey, Washington, also has a medical examiner's office. There is one down in Olmsted County, Rochester. They have a small two-doctor, one-bed area, and they serve the needs. We also have some counties in Minnesota that are served by a medical examiner's office out of South Dakota and then also North Dakota.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, thank you for that. And so there's no, the state doesn't do this. It's all county-based?
Yes. At this point, we have a coroner medical examiner system. It's kind of a patchwork quilt, really, when you look at it. There are other states that have state systems. Some have formalized county systems. In Minnesota, it's a little different. It's based per county or per agreement.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right. Further questions? Does anybody from the audience want to testify on this bill?
Mr. Chair, I do have one other testifier.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Albrecht.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Claire Roebling from Scott County. And I just want to reiterate what they said about the Joint Powers Agreement and the importance this is to our county as well as Dakota County. I know it often gets confused because it's had the Hennepin County Medical Examiner's Facilities title on it, but it really is a three-county effort. And I don't know if it was mentioned for sure, but we do represent one-third of the state's population within those three counties. So we do see this as a regional function of government, and we're hoping we can get some an appropriation for it.
All right. Thank you. Questions? All right. Anyone else want to testify on this bill? All right. Seeing none, Representative Albrecht.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to make this presentation. I think this is one of the pivot points in the growth of the industry within the state for teaching. The accreditation within the ME office is quite important as well. The list is fairly long in terms of the imperatives that go along with funding this initiative, so I will leave it at that and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Representative Albright, and thanks to the folks from the county and Commissioner Roper. All right, next up we have House File 3004, Representative Christensen. And we'll officially call the meeting to order. We do now have a quorum. Representative Heintzman moves approval of the minutes from March 22nd, 2018. All those in favor of adoption of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The minutes are adopted. And Representative Christensen is at the testifier's table with House File 3004. Representative Christensen, you can introduce our bill. We're not going to take any action on the bill today, but we do want to take testimony. Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This bill is to build a crisis stabilization intensive regional treatment services facility for mental health in Scott County, specifically in the city of Savage. I'm here to explain a little bit more about the details of the facility. Is Pam Selvig from Scott County.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Pam Selvig, and I'm the Health and Human Services Director with Scott County. I'm here today to support House File 3004, a bill seeking $1.4 million in state bonding funds for the construction of a 16-bed mental health facility in Scott County. The state funds would actually match county and nonprofit funds for the development of a proposed $2.8 million facility. The planned 16-bed program would include both short-term crisis residential beds and longer-term intensive residential treatment services. As we know, there are a growing number of individuals that have behavioral health needs. Statewide, the behavioral health system has numerous gaps, both on the front end to prevent placement at the Anoka Regional Treatment Center and at the back end for individuals ready to return to the community. The hope for this bonding request is to fill a gap in the continuum of mental health services for Scott County and surrounding communities. Scott County has seen a 96% increase in the utilization of short-term crisis beds from 2012 to 2016. This extreme shortage of beds for patients has resulted in some people sitting in emergency rooms for long hours or days as they wait for an appropriate bed in a treatment facility. Due to the shortage of nearby services, patients are frequently sent long distance. Sometimes the only beds are in facilities as far away as Duluth and Fargo. This results in moving patients from their community and from their support network. Patients being treated at Anoka also find themselves without appropriate facilities when they no longer meet the criteria for hospital-level care. Often these patients would still benefit from additional treatment in a supportive environment. Scott County has seen a 100% increase in the number of patients requiring intensive residential treatment services from 2012 to 2016, and we lack any of these services in our community. If an appropriate placement is not found, these patients stay at Anoka at a cost to counties of approximately $1,390 a day. A facility such as the one proposed in Scott County would allow for more timely, appropriate, and cost-effective services for the patient. Scott County has been working with Guild Incorporated, a private mental health provider, since 2016 around this potential development in the region. The facility would serve as an intermediate care setting with capacity to support those living in the community who need help to stabilize symptoms without hospital care. The program would also offer treatment for those transitioning from hospital level of care. We have the support of neighboring counties, our local hospital, our local mental health advisory council, and providers in the community. The barrier to the development of this much-needed service has been the initial capital costs. We hope that you would please consider support of House File 3004, as this funding would fulfill a significant gap in our continuum of mental health services for Scott County and for the region. And thank you for your time and your careful consideration of this matter.
Thank you. Are there further testifiers, Representative Christensen?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Dr. Nancy Steffen. I'm with Guild Incorporated, and I oversee our residential treatment programs. So I wanted to just echo the words that Pam shared with you. And I also want to provide some numbers and some context for some of the information that she shared. In 2016, our crisis program received over 1,500 phone calls from individuals needing residential crisis stabilization services. Of these phone calls, we were unable to provide services for 72% of these individuals, not due to a lack of not meeting criteria, but due to a lack of not having a bed available for them. So these were individuals that needed the service and could not access the service simply because there was not a bed available for them. In 2017, we received over 1,700 phone calls. Of these 1,700 phone calls, 1,143 of them were outside of Dakota County, where our current crisis program resides. That's 67%. So that means we are getting phone calls from counties like Scott County, Carver County, Coochaching County, Wilking County, Stearns County, all over the state, because these counties do not have their own residential crisis program. In 2018, so far in January and February, we have already received 271 phone calls. As you can see, the need for these residential crisis stabilization beds continues to increase, and yet the number of beds available to us has not been able to keep up with this increase in demand. We have also experienced similar trends within our residential and intensive residential treatment program, so a longer-term program. In 2016, we had a total of 197 referrals. Of these referrals, we had to decline 92 individuals, or 47%, simply because we did not have a bed available for them to stay in. In 2017, we received 260 referrals, and in 2018, just in January and February, we've received 65 referrals. That's more than a referral a day. Last year, treatment fees for one day at our program was $391. And I think Pam spoke just briefly about CASA places, regional treatment centers like Anoka. It's upwards of $1,300 a day. That means for an individual who comes with us and stays with us for 10 days at crisis, the cost for our program is roughly $3,900 for their stay, as opposed to 10 days at AMRTC, which is roughly $13,000. When we look at the longer-term impacts, if individuals are staying with us for upwards of 90 days, the cost for our program is roughly $35,000 as opposed to... Wait, I got my numbers wrong. I did my math wrong. I apologize. I'm not going to share that with you. I think it's safe to say, though, that it's more expensive than what the cost would be if they were to come and stay with us. And I also think one of the difficulties that Pam initially alluded to as well is that the treatment is then being provided outside an individual's community, which leads to a wide variety of problems and difficulties when you look at transitioning that individual back into their community. I recently completed my doctorate program, and my dissertation looked at the effectiveness of inpatient hospitalization programs versus community-based treatment programs. And the research is very clear that there's little difference in terms of the long-term outcomes for individuals, whether they attend a costly inpatient hospital-based program or whether they attend a community-based treatment program. And in fact, the research actually in some cases shows that the individuals that are able to complete a community-based treatment program go on to have more successful outcomes because there's a larger coordination of care in their treatment. So I am here in support of this bill and would ask you to take it under careful consideration and review. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Stephan. I appreciate your testimony. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, my name is Mickey Anderson, and I want to thank this committee for this opportunity to talk about this project. My goal today is to share my personal experience with Guild Incorporated and to talk about why I think this project is so important for Scott County. Let me begin by saying I'm a Scott County resident and a registered voter. Mr. Albright is my representative. I moved to Shakopee. I moved to Shakopee 9 years ago and now live in Prior Lake, Precinct 7 to be exact. I also have an 11-year affiliation with Guild Incorporated as a volunteer, donor, and employee. I first learned about the Guild when I tagged along with a friend who had been invited to an hour-long get-to-know-the-Guild presentation in St. Paul. When I arrived at the meeting, I had absolutely no idea what the Guild did. The meeting consisted of Guild clients and parents of Guild clients expressing their appreciation for the mental health services they had received from the Guild, and I was very moved by what they had to say. You see, I had a lived experience with mental illness myself. I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder and attention deficit disorder about 25 years ago, so I'm a consumer of these kind of services. As I sat there listening to them, I said to myself, these are my kind of people. I intuitively knew that getting involved with clients and Guild staff and learning about the programs they offered would be good for my mental health. The day after the meeting, I called and asked if I could do some volunteer work, and they said they would be glad to have me. One of the first things I did was to call about 150 Guild clients to conduct a customer satisfaction survey. Those clients shared their experiences with me, and many of them said many times, Guild has saved my life, and you know what? I believe them. In addition to volunteering, which I still do, the Guild offered me a part-time position to work in one of their facilities in St. Paul. For many years, I had hoped that I would have the opportunity to share my experience, strength, and hope with those who had mental illness, health issues, as well as substance abuse problems. My life focus became giving others help, as I knew what many of them went through. My workload increased, and when the opportunity to work on a full-time basis as a peer recovery specialist, I took it, a position I hold today. A peer recovery specialist is a counselor, coach-type, non-clinician-type person who is required to have a lived experience with mental illness. In addition to my work with a girl, I also have been very active in Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous programs in Scott County. I did the meetings in Prior Lake, Savage, and Shakopee. I would often share with my clean and sober friends about the work that I did and how I wished there was an AIDS crisis program in Scott County. The question I always got from them was, why don't we have an AIDS crisis program in Scott County? And of course, I had no answer for them. You see, many of those individuals, and myself included, knew other people that had both mental health and abuse substances challenges, and there really was no place for them to go except to go to other counties. Which brings me to the story, and I'm wrapping this thing up, of a recent graduate of the Guild AIDS program in South St. Paul. When this young man came to the program, he was homeless, had a criminal record, was oblivious to being mentally ill, had a long history of substance abuse, especially with his favorite drug of choice, marijuana. The AIDS team worked very hard to teach him how to deal with his mental health symptoms. Found a place to live, and come to recognition that continued use of drugs and alcohol would be very detrimental to his mental health recovery. Who knows, maybe someday I'll be the first peer recovery specialist in Scott County. That would make my dream come true. I want to thank this committee for this opportunity, and I'm sure this august body will have the wisdom to do the right thing in supporting this capital investment. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Anderson, thank you for your testimony. My question is to you, but also I have a follow-on question for Ms. Steffen. So to either one of you, but I understand about the parameters of the size, but with the facts that were presented, it certainly compels me to ask, unfortunately, you know, 16 beds is woefully inadequate for the number of requests that you're getting. And so what other alternatives do we have in Scott County or as a state to remedy the situation?
Well, I can only speak from my experience. There are no other options as far as the IRS program in Scott County. There are no options that I'm aware of. And secondly, I think what will happen is when people get referred by case managers in different counties, they're going to try to find the nearest bed they can find, which is difficult to handle. And so they come to us in Dakota County at South St. Paul. Maybe Nancy could address that more than I could.
Welcome back to the committee, Ms. Steffen.
Thank you. What my colleague Mick responded with is fairly accurate. There's a significant shortage within the entire state, but especially when you look at rural communities and the continuum of mental health services and care. The number of crisis stabilization beds is just willfully inadequate. So what ends up happening is usually an individual getting sent to the emergency room and ends up staying there for usually an exorbitant amount of time, and then is discharged back into their community, which perpetuates the cycle of they go back into their community, they're continuing to struggle without the supports, and they end up utilizing the emergency room and department yet again in the near future. So I think one of the great things about our Earth in Crisis programs is we're able to break that cycle to really step in and provide these additional supports and skills and services so that when somebody is discharged from our program, hopefully the amount of time between those hospitalization periods is longer. That's one of our primary goals. Yeah. Does that answer your question?
Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Representative. Thank you. Ms. Steffen, oftentimes it's not just one problem that is presented to. I'm just wondering about codependency. Typically, these are also these individuals are suffering not only from mental incapacitation, but substance abuse. We've talked a lot in the last couple of days about trauma-informed treatment for children. Looking at it from a holistic perspective, I'm wondering if you could speak to that in terms of how this type of facility would either coordinate or facilitate those types of consultations as well.
Yes. I'm glad you brought that up. I got a little bit nervous and skipped that part of my speech. So, yes, we offer what are called co-occurring programs. So we provide groups. Nick facilitates some of those, Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous and Healthy Realization Groups, all of which focus on this co-occurrence between substance use and mental health. There's a pretty significant rate of co-occurrence. Individuals that struggle with mental health usually struggle with some sort of substance use or addiction as well. And so we have a co-occurring program set up where about 50% of our groups are based on mental health. How do we develop coping skills? How do we develop life skills? And then how do we address that co-occurring addiction component? In terms of trauma-informed care, what we utilize right now is called the Seeking Safety Curriculum, which is an evidence-based curriculum model that really looks at how do we take into account an individual's trauma and the impact that has on their ability to function. And there's a lot of different aspects that we can take into consideration, including sort of the structure of the actual physical space, as well as the staff that we hire, as well as the treatment interventions and modalities that we utilize. So those are definitely things that we're able to provide and take careful consideration when we're looking at developing our program.
Thank you, Ms. Steffen.
Yeah.
Representative Loeffler. Oh, okay. All right. Do you have any further testifiers, Representative Christensen?
Yes. Mr. Chair, yes, we do.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Please come on down, introduce yourself for the record, and proceed.
Thank you for the opportunity to tell my family story. I am the Scott County Affiliate Chair for NAVI, and I'm also the Mayor of Savage. And our 51-year-old son, pardon me?
And your name is?
Oh, I'm sorry, Janet Williams.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Williams.
Okay. Our 51-year-old son lives with a serious and persistent mental illness, also called a biological brain disease. Statistics show that 1 in 5 people live with this mental illness. 1 in 5. Just look around the room. There's anxiety, depression, PTSD, schizophrenia, borderline personality, and hoarding. We have 3 sons, and our middle son was an intelligent, outstanding athlete in hockey and soccer, an avid hunter and fisherman, loving, kind, nonviolent, never been in jail, and lives with us. And his goal is to take care of us. In his mid-20s, he came home from living in Georgia, and then it was evident that something was wrong. He thought there were people in the house. He was hearing voices. He wouldn't leave the house. He knew that he wasn't feeling right, and it is common for those having such experiences to use alcohol and street drugs. We had no experience with mental illness and were relieved to learn about county services. A psychiatrist from the county and a case manager came to the house and diagnosed him with a serious mental illness. Finally, after he took him to St. Francis, the protocol was to call the Scott County Crisis Team. So we waited for hours for them to come, where he was housed in a cell and he was hearing voices. After they arrived and did an assessment, he was strapped on a gurney in his psychotic state and transported to Brainerd because there were no beds in the metropolitan area. 20 years ago, the state closed state facilities and promoted local community-based services. Well, that hasn't happened. And our son is on his journey that has been to St. Peter, Anoka, Cedar Riverside, North Memorial, St. Joe's, New Ulm, 2 commitments, a translation home in Mankato, another in Duluth, MRCI, and ERTS. And with all of that, I can assure you that no one brought us the hot dish. A wonderful counselor helped my husband and me grieve the loss of the expectations that we had for our son. His future and the expectations that we thought about his future, and to accept him as he was. That led us to NAMI, the help that we needed to take care of ourselves to be of the help to him. Through all of this, our son is a great son who has much to teach us. And yes, he does not like feeling whacked out on his medications and is discouraged when they lose their efficacy. Most people don't know what to say, and so they do nothing. And then there's the stigma, and that's another whole topic. Finally, our county is saying enough of this broken system. We have the match for this money. We have a nonprofit willing to operate it. We ask your support for this bill. We will then have crisis for people for a couple of days for stabilization rather than to send them off to the hospital. We will have a 90-day treatment program that's in our county to help our people. As a mother who's been coping with this system, I urge you to pass this. Enough is enough. To move beyond maintenance, we need to seek recovery. We know there's no quick cure, but we will never give up hope. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Williams. All right. Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to present this bill in front of you. This project is ready to go. It's you're all familiar with the need, and I think it's really important.
All right. And Representative Christensen, the total amount for that one?
Mr. Chair, it's $1.4
million. All right. Further questions for Representative Christensen or any of the testifiers? All right. Seeing none, thank you, Representative Christensen.
Thank you.
All right. And members, there's a correction in the minutes. We should have had March 21st instead of 2nd. Representative Albright moves approval of the minutes from March 21st, 2018. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Those are adopted. Representative Franson. Representative Franson has House File 3537. Representative Franson, to your bill and project.
Yes, actually, I need a copy of my bill. Left it on my chair, I mean, not my desk, you know what I mean? All right. Thank you, members of the committee. So over the last 10 years, White Earth has been partnering with the state in different programs, such as youth treatment facility in Bemidji, Indian Child Welfare Transfer, Human Services Transfer, and now to provide drug treatment to adults. Leveraging federal dollars has had a big impact on savings for county and state budgets, bringing monies up for other demanding issues. And I'd like to turn over the testimony to Jerry Jaskin, who would like to speak a little bit more on House File 3537.
Mr. Chair and committee members, good afternoon. My name is Jerry Jaskin. I'm the Behavioral Health Division Director for the White Earth Band of Ojibwe. I've served as the Behavioral Health Division Director for 3 years, and prior to that, you may have seen me here as the Director of Indian Child Welfare for 18 years. So I can speak at various facets of how the opiate crisis has impacted the White Earth community. From overdoses to impacts hitting our families, our Child Welfare Department experienced significant increases in child protection cases, foster care placements nearly doubling, as heroin impacted 80% of all of our foster care cases on White Earth. It impacted our behavioral health systems by requiring more assessors, the need for same-day assessments, and treatment admissions into our outpatient treatment as well as inpatient treatment systems. White Earth has been very progressive and aggressive in implementation of treatment programs that address this opioid crisis. We'd like to thank this committee for the appropriation made in 2007 that assisted us in purchasing the Oshkeganu Residential Treatment Facility. And we'd like to let you know that since 2007, Oshkeganu has assisted hundreds of women with their children in placement with them at the residential treatment facility, successfully complete substance use disorder treatment. In 2016, in response to the opioid crisis, Oshkeganu Treatment Center shifted focus to be an opioid treatment facility, which allows women with their children in residential treatment while providing integrated care services, including medication-assisted treatment. For the past 2 years, this facility has maintained a 20-person waiting list, and that doesn't even touch the amount of clients that are turned away each week that don't bother to get put on the list because it's such a long wait. White Earth needs to be able to provide more beds for residential treatment. We're requesting dollars to be able to provide an additional 25 beds for adult inpatient treatment to address this opioid crisis. White Earth has provided significant cost savings to the state by implementing innovative inpatient and outpatient treatment programs. We have approximately 60 moms in our outpatient treatment programs through the MOMS program in medication-assisted treatment who all have their children with them and have avoided foster care placement. We have 200 individuals in our MAT programs, many of whom are parents and have their children at home. We've had over 30 graduates from these two programs alone who have become full-time employees of our programs. They've moved on to become counselors themselves, peer support, and care coordinators. The members, so the number of our graduates continue to grow each month, and our employment numbers continue to grow each month as well. The Moms MAP program have been carried by Blighter through third-party reimbursements for services, and the tribe intends to continue to leverage federal dollars to sustain the additional opiate treatment beds. And I thank you for your time and consideration of this proposal.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. Thank you so much for sitting with us this afternoon and giving us some time to talk about the opiate initiative at White Earth. So my name is Autumn Amberday. I'm a psychiatrist and addiction medicine physician for White Earth Nation. Every year, thousands of Minnesotans become addicted to opiates, and hundreds of them every year lose their lives to this addiction. In 2015, there were 395 opioid overdose deaths, which is an 18% increase from the year before. The numbers reflect that American Indians have been hit disproportionately hard. In 2015, American Indian Minnesotans were five times more likely to die from a drug overdose than non-Native Minnesotans. We're asking your support to help us, White Earth Nation, improve treatment options for community members in the areas greatest affected. Opioid misuse is harming our communities. People are dying from the overdoses. As Jerry said, children are being taken from their families. And as treatment providers and facilities, we're under-resourced. Each year, White Earth completes between 1,200 and 15 Rule 25 assessments, which are the chemical dependency assessments that rate the severity and make treatment recommendations for patients. A lot of their patients are referred to outpatients, medication-assisted treatment, or the MOMS program, which is the Maternal Outreach and Mitigation Services. It's MAP program with additional parenting and supportive services. A significant population are referred to inpatient treatment. White Earth inpatient facilities also receive referrals from outside resources as well, other tribes and counties. So the MOMS program is an innovative treatment program impacting pregnant mothers and their babies under White Earth Nation. It includes a culturally specific treatment program with daily outpatient substance use where they come in and get dosed every day with buprenorphine. They have mental health services, so we do treat a comprehensive in a fashion for all the moms and their family members. Families are able to stay together. Children are able to come to treatment with their mothers, which has been incredibly successful for us. One of the greatest reasons women don't seek treatment is they're worried about the implications on their families. Their children will be taken for them, or they don't have anyone to watch their children when they go to treatment. So we're very unique that families can stay together. We have registered nurses on site that work with our patients and have daily contact with them. And the medication-assisted treatment, we use buprenorphine or buprenorphine naloxone combination, which is a partial opiate agonist. It alleviates the craving. It decreases the use of opiates. It blocks the effects of other opiates, and it helps people engage and stay in treatment. Our treatment serves men, women, and adolescents. However, our priority is for pregnant-using mothers, since continued use of opiates has serious implications during the perinatal period. Our programs are very successful and have led to a significant reduction in the number of babies born with neonatal abstinence syndrome, leading to healthier newborns, healthier moms, healthier families. So it's a very good program. As Jerry said, the Ashkimanidu has been very successful. We're asking for additional support to enhance the services. Thank you for your time today and your careful consideration.
Thank you, Dr. Amberday, for your testimony. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author of the bill. Representative Franzen, I'm looking at the body of the bill itself. And I know the appropriation is left blank, but yet then on the information provided in our jacket at the bottom, I do note a request is mentioned of $1 million. So I'm just wondering if that is the amount that you're requesting or if that's just for the renovations of part of the facilities, or what is the total ask?
Yes, thank you, Representative Albright. The ask would be $1 million.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Further questions?
I have a question.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And a question to either testifier, Ms. Amberday, or Ms. Jansen.
Justin.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, if you'd just allow me a little bit of latitude here. I chair the Agriculture Finance Committee, And so my question would be, and this could possibly be addressed outside of the committee here, but what else as a state could we be doing to help WIDER, whether it's economic development, education, jobs, whatever? And so that's kind of an open question, Mr. Chairman, but you know, as the chairman of Ag Finance, help us understand, or myself, you know, understand what other things can we assist with or we can be doing. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Certainly economic development is a huge deal at White Earth, and I know that you know, the legislature has been really helpful to us in the past with several initiatives that have been really successful in areas of economic development, including some of the technical college approaches to some of our kids in Circle of Life Academy, for example, and being able to you know, impact their skills and training while in high school and leading to future jobs. So, you know, that's certainly an area of keen interest to White Earth, but, you know, law enforcement is a big area to us as well, and support for our law enforcement, especially as we're looking at the opioid crisis. Certainly any area within health and human services is certainly helpful to us as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Further questions? One I just have for Dr. Amberday. The some of the things that we have kind of struggle with around opioids is just the sheer numbers that we're seeing. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you see the numbers and you hear anecdotes, and the numbers are just too big to think that they're real. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's one of the things that we're kind of struggling with, is to try to figure out what we're going to, you know, we're going to try to work on passing legislation and deal with some of this at different places along the way, from free prescription to antidotes all along the chain. And the when you say there's a five times, one of, just to give you an example, we were looking at the bags, disposal bags for extra opioid pills, where you dump water in and dispose of them so that they don't get inappropriately used when they're done. And so we asked how many prescriptions are given out every year, just so we can kind of put some scale to that, for just how many bags would you need if you had one for every single bottle, you know, as you start there and you kind of work your way around. And the numbers that we got back, and it was at the end of the session, and the numbers that we got back were so huge, I looked at them and I thought, well, that can't be right. But in fact, we found out that actually it is right. And when you say that there's a five times incidence for Native Americans, it's not 5% more, it's not 25% more, 500% more. And I've also heard when you talk about, I don't know the condition when a baby is born kind of addicted. I don't know what the name of that is, or what the medical term for that is. But it's an incredibly high number I've heard anecdotally from hospitals where moms deliver. Can you talk about what the numbers might be from what you're seeing and where moms deliver from where you are?
Yeah, that's a great question. Interesting. It is staggering. Thank you for the question, Mr. Chairman. And I don't have the exact numbers of the babies born in the hospitals where we are. And the White Earth service areas, we're in the White Earth proper on the reservation, Bemidji, the urban area, in Natchitoches, we have different clinic treatment sites throughout the state of Minnesota, so the numbers would be a little bit different. Babies who we often say are born addicted, they're not really addicted, they're physically dependent on the opioid. You know, babies aren't able to be addicted, but they have that dependence, that withdrawal syndrome. So the neonatal abstinence syndrome is what you're speaking with, where they're suffering from opioid withdrawal when they're born. So with treatment, the length of time babies are able to stay in the hospital are much shorter. So with treatment, moms who are on this medication, about half the cases, babies will still have that withdrawal syndrome those frequencies are much shorter. So like I said, about half the babies don't have any type of withdrawal. The other ones, up 2 to 3 days is average that they have that withdrawal. Moms who are using or not in the program or are using sporadically, those babies are in the hospital for over a week. Their symptoms are much significantly stronger. A lot of those babies need to be treated with morphine or other medications to help. So the number, the frequency and severity of the babies is about half when you're in a treatment program. Some of the babies not experiencing any signs of withdrawal. Moms who are in treatment also have supportive services with them. So they have parental support. They have mental health there. They have their counselors. So there's a lot of other things that help keep the family intact as well. But if you're interested, we could probably look at getting some exact numbers.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to answer part of that because we do have some pretty significant statistics related to our babies born on White Earth Reservation. So in 2014 and 2015, each year respectively, we had 48 babies born positive, testing positive for heroin, requiring hospitalization. There was no treatment for the moms leading up to this point. And what we saw when we implemented the moms program in 2016 is that number reduced to one. So in answer to your question, Representative, there are some initiatives tribally, the Indian Child Welfare Initiative, the Gijawaso Initiative, the MOMS programs types of initiatives that can make huge impact. So when you allow tribes to have this authority back again to operate affairs, you can see these tremendous impacts, you know, as a result. So.
Thank you. And we have requested from the Department of Health a census and breakdown of what they have for reportable births statewide, but if you had specific reported information for total numbers of births, and that would be great for White Earth as we go forward. And I know that the standard of care for pregnant moms being treated after birth is moving from residential to outpatient as a standard of care. And so it sounds like you would actually be able to keep the moms and the kids together in a residential program, which would be extraordinarily rare. So I think that's a really good idea and proposal, and it's not one that we have seen. So that's really exciting and cool about this. The one thing that I just thought of when I looked at this project earlier, and sometimes when nonprofits are looking at construction projects, one of the things that they tend to do is not ask for enough money because you're always trying to do things on a shoestring. And one of the worst things you can do sometimes is not get properly funded on construction. And if anything, this looks to me like you might want to take another look at your construction numbers and your renovation numbers to see if it's enough, because I know that there would be a tremendous amount of support for that, but I'd hate to see you not be able to get all the way through completion and fit out for your facility so that you can actually get it up and running. Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and I just want to comment on especially the last thing you talked about, moving to one baby born dependent or experiencing that. And I think this legislature, and in many cases Minnesotans feel overwhelmed by and somewhat paralyzed by the staggering numbers that we hear around opioids. And here you are telling us the story of progress. And that is, I think, really important for us to hear and important for Minnesotans to hear, that often we miss, when something seems so daunting, the path forward, and you're showing us one. And I'm grateful for that, and I bet the committee is too.
All right. Does anyone else want to testify on this House file and this project? I see none. Any other member questions for the testifiers or Representative Franson? Seeing none, Representative Franson?
No, I just want to thank the testifiers for being here. You know, it is, while there was some sad numbers in here, but it was also a story of hope. And I'm optimistic about this project going through, and I'm sure that they will take a look at those numbers and make sure everything is on par, and if not, come back and talk to me and talk to you, and thank you for that suggestion. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Representative Franz, and thank you to the testifiers for the good work you're doing and also for traveling down to meet with us today. We do appreciate that. Members, we're going to be hearing bills that have no fiscal cost or SGSR next week, so we're going to be trying to pack them in. So if we could get here right at 1, that would be great so we can get up and running. We would appreciate that. We do have a number of bills as we are heading out of policy and back in to finance, so our plate will be very full. With that, members, we are